You keep smiling a pleasant smile in front of Matic, but all I can see anymore is bared teeth. I am not sure what to say to that. She puts on a long, fur-trimmed green coat with frog clasps.
Where is the girl?
In the stables, I say. I'll take you. Vivi shakes her head.
Absolutely not. You have to get out of those clothes. Put on a dress and go down to dinner and make sure you act like everything's normal. If someone comes to question you, tell them you've been in your room this whole time.
No one saw me, I say. Vivi gives me her best fish-eyed look.
No one? You're sure?
I think of Cardin, riding up as we made our escape, and of the guards, whom I'd lied to.
Probably no one, I amend.
No one who noticed anything. If Cardin had, he would never have let me get away. He would never have given up having that much power over me.
Yeah, that's what I thought, she says, holding up a forbidding long-fingered hand. Jude, it isn't safe.
I'm going, I insist. The girl's name is Sophie, and she's really freaked out.
Vivi snorts. I bet.
I don't think she'll go with you. You look like one of them. Maybe I am more afraid of my nerve running out than anything else. I worry about the adrenaline ebbing out of my body, leaving me to face the mad thing I have done. But given Sophie's suspicion of me, I absolutely think that Vivi's cat eyes would be enough to send her over the edge. Because you are one of them.
Are you telling me in case I forgot?
Vivi asks. We've got to go, I say. And I am coming. We don't have time to debate this.
Come then, she says.
Together we go down the stairs. But as we are about to go out the door, she grabs my shoulder.
You can't save our mother, you know.
She's already dead.
I feel as though she has slapped me. That's not...
Isn't it?
She demands.
Isn't that what you're doing? Tell me this girl isn't some stand-in for mom. Some surrogate.
I want to help Sophie, I say, shrugging off her grip. Just Sophie. Outside, the moon is high in the sky, turning the leaves silver. Vivi goes out to pick a bouquet of ragwort stalks.
Fine. Then go get this Sophie.
She is where I left her, hunched in the hay, rocking back and forth and talking softly to herself. I am relieved to see her, relieved she didn't run off, and we weren't even now tracking her through the forest. Relieved that someone from Balekin's household hadn't ferreted out her location and hauled her away. Okay, I say with forced cheerfulness. We're ready.
Yes, she says, standing up.
Her face is tear-stained, but she's no longer crying. She looks like she's in shock. It's going to be okay, I tell her again, but she doesn't answer. She follows me mutely out behind the stables where Vivi is waiting, along with two raw-boned ponies with green eyes and lacy manes. Sophie looks at them and then at Vivi. She begins to back away, shaking her head. When I come near her, she backs away from me, too.
No, 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 she says. Please, no, no more, no.
It's only a very little bit of magic, Vivi says reasonably. But it's still coming from someone with lightly furred points on her ears and eyes that flash gold in the dark. Just a smidgen, and then you won't ever have to see another magical thing. You'll be back in the mortal world, the daylight world, the normal world. But this is the only way to get you there. We're going to fly.
No, Sophie says, her voice coming out broken.
Let's walk to the cliffside near here, I say. You'll be able to see the lights, maybe even a few boats. You'll feel better when you can see a destination.
We don't have a lot of time, Vivi reminds me with a significant look. It's not far, I argue. I don't know what else to do. The only other choices I can think of are knocking her unconscious or asking Vivi to glamour her. Both are terrible. And so we walk through the woods, ragwort steeds following. Sophie doesn't balk. The walk seems to calm her. She picks up rocks as we go, smooth stones that she dusts the dirt from and then puts in her pockets. Do you remember your life from before? I ask her. She nods and doesn't speak for a little while. But then she turns back to me. She gives a weird, croaking laugh. I always wanted there to be magic, she says. Isn't that funny? I wanted there to be an Easter Bunny and a Santa Claus and a Tinkerbell. I remember Tinkerbell. But I don't want it. I don't want it anymore. I know, I say. And I do. I have wished for many things over the years. But the first wish of my heart was that none of it was real. At the water's edge, Vivi mounts one of the steeds and puts Sophie up before her. I swing up onto the back of the other. Sophie gives the forest a trembling look and then glances over at me. She doesn't seem afraid. She seems as though maybe she's starting to believe that the worst is behind her. Hold on tight, Vivi says, and her steed kicks up off the cliff and into the air. Mine follows. The wild exhilaration of flying hits me, and I grin with familiar delight. Beneath us are the white-capped waves, and ahead the shimmering lights of mortal towns, like a mysterious land strewn with stars. I glance over at Sophie, hoping to give her a reassuring smile. Sophie isn't looking at me, though. Her eyes are closed. And then, as I am watching, she tilts to one side, lets go of the steed's mane, and lets herself fall. Vivi grabs for her, but it's too late. She is plunging soundlessly through the night sky toward the mirrored darkness of the sea. When she hits, there is barely even a splash. I cannot speak. Everything seems to slow around me. I think of Sophie's cracked lips. Think of her saying, please, just tell me this isn't real. I don't think I can live with any of this being real. I think of the stones she filled her pockets with. I hadn't been listening. I hadn't wanted to hear her. I'd just wanted to save her. And now, because of me, she is dead. Chapter 18. I wake up groggy. I cried myself to sleep, and now my eyes are swollen and red, my head pounding. The whole previous night feels like a feverish, terrible nightmare. It doesn't seem possible that I snuck into Balekin's house and stole one of his servants. It seems even less possible that she preferred to drown than to live with the memories of Fairy. As I drink fennel tea and shrug on a doublet, Narbonne comes to my door.
Your pardon, he says with a short bow. June must come immediately.
Tatterfell waves him off.
She's not fit to see anyone right at the moment. I'll send her down when she's dressed.
Prince Dane awaits her downstairs in General Maddox's parlor. He commanded me to fetch her, and not to mind whatever state of dishabille she was in. He said to carry her if I had to.
Narbonne seems repentant at having to say that, but it's clear that none of us can refuse the Crown Prince. Cold dread coils in my stomach. And how did I not think that he, of all people, with his spies, would find out what I'd done? I wipe my hands against my velvet top,
Despite his order, I pull on pants and boots before I go. No one stops me. I am vulnerable enough. I will keep what dignity I can. Prince Dane is standing near the window, behind Maddox's desk. His back is to me, and my gaze goes automatically to the sword hanging from his belt, visible beneath his heavy wool cloak. He does not turn when I come in. "I have done wrong," I say. I am glad he stays where he is. It's easier to speak when he's not looking at me. And I will repent in whatever way. He turns, his face full of wild rage that makes me suddenly see his resemblance to Cardin. His hand comes down hard on Maddox's desk, rocking everything atop it.
"Have I not taken you into my service and given you a great boon? Did I not promise you a place in my court? And yet, you use what I have taught you to endanger my plans."
My gaze goes to the floor. He has the power to do anything to me. Anything. Not even Maddox could stop him. Nor do I think he would try. And not only have I disobeyed him, I have declared my loyalty to something completely separate from him. I have helped a mortal girl. I have acted like a mortal. I bite my bottom lip to keep from begging for his forgiveness. I cannot allow myself to speak.
"The boy wasn't as badly hurt as he might have been. But with the right knife, a longer knife, the strike would have been lethal. Do not think I don't know you were going for that worst strike."
I look up suddenly, too surprised to hide it. We look at each other for several uncomfortable moments. I stare into the silvered gray of his eyes, taking note of the way his brows furrow, forming deep, displeased lines. I note all this to avoid thinking of how I almost gave away an even greater crime than the one he's discovered.
"Well?"
he demands.
"Had you no plan for being found out?"
He tried to glamour me into jumping out of the tower, I say.
"And so he knows you can't be glamoured. Worse and worse."
He comes around the desk toward me.
"You are my creature, Jude Duarte. You will strike only when I tell you to strike. Otherwise, stay your hand. Do you understand?"
"No," I say automatically. What he's asking is ridiculous. Was I supposed to just let him hurt me? If he knew all the things I'd really done, he would be even angrier than he is. He slams a dagger down on Maddox's desk.
"Pick it up,"
he says, and I feel the compulsion of a glamour. My fingers close on the hilt. A kind of haziness comes over me. I both know and don't know what I am doing.
"In a moment, I am going to ask you to put the blade through your hand. When I ask you to do that, I want you to remember where your bones are, where your veins are. I want you to stab through your hand, doing the least damage possible."
His voice is lulling, hypnotic, but my heart speeds anyway. Against my will, I aim the sharp point of the knife. I press it lightly against my skin. I am ready. I hate him, but I am ready. I hate him, and I hate myself.
"Now,"
he says. And the glamour releases me. I take half a step back. I am in control of myself again, still holding the knife. He was about to make...
"Do not disappoint me,"
Prince Dane says. I realize all at once that I have not gotten a reprieve. He hasn't released me because he wants to spare me. He could glamour me again. but he won't, because he wants me to stab myself willingly. He wants me to prove my devotion. Blood and bone. I hesitate. Of course I hesitate. This is absurd. This is awful. This isn't how people show loyalty. This is epic. Epic bullshit.
Jude?
He asks. I cannot tell if this is a test he expects me to pass or one he wants me to fail. I think of Sophie at the bottom of the sea. Her pockets full of stones. I think of the satisfaction on Valerian's face when he told me to jump from the tower. I think of Cardin's eyes, daring me to defy him. I have tried to be better than them, and I have failed. What could I become if I stopped worrying about death, about pain, about anything? If I stopped trying to belong. Instead of being afraid, I could become something to fear. My eyes on him, I slam the knife into my hand. The pain is a wave that rises higher and higher, but never crashes. I make a sound low in my throat. I may not deserve punishment for this, but I deserve punishment. Dane's expression is odd, blank. He takes a step back from me, as though I am the one who did the shocking thing instead of merely doing what he ordered. Then he clears his throat.
Do not reveal your skill with a blade,
he says.
Do not reveal your mastery over glamour. Do not reveal all that you can do. Show your power by appearing powerless. That is what I need from you.
Yes, I gasp, and draw the blade out again. Blood runs over Maddox's desk, more than I expect. I feel suddenly dizzy.
Wipe it up,
he says. His jaw is set. Whatever surprise he felt seems gone, replaced by something else. There is nothing to clean the desk with but the hem of my doublet.
Now give me your hand.
Reluctantly, I hold it out to him, but all he does is take it gently and wrap it in a green cloth from his pocket. I try to flex my fingers and nearly pass out from the pain. The fabric of the makeshift bandage is already turning dark.
Once I am gone, go to the kitchens and put moss on it.
I nod again. I am not sure I can translate my thoughts into speech. I am afraid I am not going to be able to stand much longer. But I walk my knees and stare at the notch of chipped wood on Maddox's desk where the tip of the blade hit, stained a bright but fading red. The door to the study swings open, startling us both. Prince Dane drops my hand, and I shove it into my pocket, the pain of which nearly staggers me. Oriana stands there, a wooden tray in her hands with a steaming pot and three clay cups atop it. She is dressed in a day gown, the vivid hue of unripe persimmons. Prince Dane, she says, making a pretty bow. The servants said you were sequestered with Jude, and I told them they had to be mistaken. Surely, with your coronation so close, your time is too valuable for a silly girl to take up so much of it. You do her too much credit. And no doubt the weight of your regard is quite overwhelming.
No doubt,
he says, giving her a tooth-gritting smile.
I have tarried too long.
Take some tea before you leave us, she says, putting down the tray on Maddox's desk. We could all have a cup and speak together. If Jude has done something to offend you,
your pardon, he says, not particularly kindly. But your reminder of my duty spurs me to immediate action.
He brushes past Oriana, looking back at me once before stalking off. I have no idea whether I passed the test or not. But either way, he does not trust me as he once did. I have thrown that away. I don't trust him as much either. Thank you, I say to Oriana. I am shivering all over. She doesn't scold me for once. She doesn't say anything. Her hands come down lightly on my shoulders, and I lean against her. The scent of crushed verbena is in my nose. I close my eyes and drink in the familiar smell. I am desperate. I will take any comfort there is. Any comfort at all. I do not think of lessons or lectures. Shaking all over, I go straight back to my room and climb into bed. Tatterfell strokes my hair briefly, as though I am a drowsy cat, and then returns to the task of sorting my dresses. My new gown is scheduled to arrive later today, and the coronation will begin the day after. Dane's being named as the High King will kick off a month of revelry, while the moon wanes and then swells anew. My hand hurts so much that I cannot bear to put moss on it. I just cradle it against my chest. It throbs, the pain coming in staggering pulses, like a second, ragged heartbeat. I cannot bring myself to do more than lie there and wait for it to ebb. My thoughts drift dizzily. Somewhere out there, all the lords and ladies and lieges ruling over far-flung courts are arriving to pay their respects to the new High King. Night courts and bright courts, free courts and wild courts. The High King's subjects and the courts with which there are truces, however wobbly. Even Orla's court of the undersea will be in attendance. Many will pledge themselves to faithfully accept the new High King's judgment in exchange for his wisdom and protection. Pledge to defend him and avenge him, if need be. Then all will show their respect by partying their hardest. I'll be expected to party along with them. A month of dancing and feasting and boozing and riddling and dueling. For that, each of my best dresses must be dusted off, pressed, and refreshed. Tatterfell sews on cunning cuffs made from the scales of pine cones around the edges of frayed sleeves. Small tears in skirts are stitched over with embroidery in the shape of leaves and pomegranates, and, on one, a cavorting fox. She has stitched dozens of leather slippers for me. I will be expected to dance so fiercely that I wear through a pair every night. At least Locke will be there to dance with me. I try to concentrate on the memory of his amber eyes, instead of the pain in my hand. As Tatterfell moves around the room, my eyes close, and I fall into a strange, fitful sleep. When I wake, it's full night, and I am sweaty all over. I feel oddly calm, though. Tears and panic and pain somehow smoothed over. The agony of my hand has turned into a dull throb. Tatterfell is gone. Vivi is sitting at the end of my bed, her cat eyes catching moonlight and shining chartreuse. I came to see if you were well, she says. Except that, of course, you're not. I force myself to sit up again, using only one of my hands. I'm sorry. What I asked you to do, I shouldn't have. I put you in danger.
I am your elder sister, she says. You don't need to protect me from my own decisions.
After Sophie plunged into the water, Vivi and I spent the hours until dawn diving into the icy sea, calling for Sophie, trying to find some trace of her. We swam under the black water and screamed her name until our throats were hoarse. "Still," I say.
"Still,"
she echoes fiercely.
"I wanted to help. I wanted to help that girl."
"Too bad we didn't," the words catch in my throat. Vivienne shrugs, and I am reminded of how, despite her being my sister, we differ in ways that are hard to comprehend.
"You did a brave thing.
Be glad of that.
Not everyone can be brave. I'm not always."
"What do you mean? The whole not telling Heather what's really going on?" She makes a face at me, but smiles, clearly grateful I am speaking of something less dire. And yet both of our thoughts went from one dead mortal girl to her beloved, also mortal.
"We were lying in bed together a few days ago," Vivi says, "and she started tracing the shape of my ear. I thought she was going to ask something that would give me an opening, but she just told me my ear modding was really good." "Did you know there are mortals who cut human ears and sew them so they heal pointed?"
I am not surprised. I understand longing for ears like hers. I feel like I have spent half my life wanting them, with their delicate, furred points. What I do not say is this. No one could touch those ears and believe they were made by anything other than nature. Heather is either lying to Vivi or lying to herself.
"I don't want her to be afraid of me," Vivi says.
I think of Sophie, and I am sure Vivi is thinking of her too. Pockets full of stones. Sophie at the bottom of the sea. Perhaps she is not so unaffected by what happens as she wants to seem. From downstairs, I hear Taryn's voice.
"They're here! Our dresses! Come look!"
Slipping off my bed, Vivi smiles at me.
"At least we had an adventure. And now, we're going to have another one."
I let her go ahead, as I need to cover my bandaged hand with a glove before I follow her down the stairs. I press a button, ripped from a coat, over the wound to divert direct pressure. Now I have to hope that the bulge on my palm isn't too noticeable. Our gowns have been spread out over three chairs and a sofa in Oriana's salon. Maddox is patiently listening to her rhapsodize over the perfection of their garments. Her ball gown is the exact pink of her eyes, deepening to red, and seems to be made of enormous petals that spread into a train. The fabric of Taryn's is gorgeous. The cut of her mantua and stomacher perfect. Beside them is Oak's sweet little suit of clothes, and there are a doublet and cape for Matic in his favorite shade of crusted blood red. Vivi holds up her silvery gray dress with its tattered edges, sparing a smile for me. Across the room, I see my gown. Taryn gasps when I lift it up.
"That's not what you ordered," she says, accusatory,
as though somehow I have deliberately deceived her. It's true that the dress I am holding is not the one that Brambleweft sketched for me. It's something else entirely, something that reminds me of the mad, amazing garments that Locke's mother's closet was stuffed with. An ombre ball gown, its color deepening from white near my throat, through the palest blue, to deepest indigo at my feet. Over that is stitched the stark outlines of trees, the way I see them from my window as dusk is falling. The seamstress has even sewn on little crystal beads to represent stars. This is a dress I could never have imagined. One so perfect that, for a moment, looking at it, I can think of nothing but its beauty. I don't think this is mine, I say. Taryn's right. It doesn't look anything like the sketches. It's still lovely, Oriana says consolingly, as though I am displeased,
and it had your name pinned to it. I am glad no one is making me give it back. I do not know why I was given such a dress, but if there's any way I can fit into it, I will. Maddock raises his brows.
We will all look magnificent.
When he walks past, departing the salon, he ruffles my hair. In moments like these, it is almost possible to think there is no river of spilled blood between us all. Oriana claps her hands together. Girls, come here for a moment. Attend me. We three arrange ourselves on the couch beside her, waiting, puzzled. Tomorrow, you will be among the gentry from many different courts. You've been under Maddox's protection, but that protection will be unknown to most of the folk in attendance. You must not allow yourselves to be lured into making bargains or promises that can be used against you. And, above all, give no insult that might excuse a trespass of hospitality. Do not be foolish, and do not put yourself in anyone's power.
We are never foolish, Taryn says. A blatant lie, if ever there was one.
Oriana makes a pained face.
I would keep you from the revels, but Maddock has specifically instructed that you participate in them. So heed my advice. Be careful, and perhaps you will find ways to be pleasing. I should have expected this.
More cautions, another lecture. If she does not trust us to behave at a revel, she certainly will not trust us at a coronation. We rise, dismissed, and she takes each of us in turn, pressing her chilly mouth against our cheeks. My kiss comes last.
Do not aspire above your station, she says softly to me.
For a moment, I don't understand why she would say that. Then, horrified, I get her meaning. After this afternoon, she thinks I am Prince Dane's lover. I'm not, I blurt out. Of course, Cardin would say that everything I've got is above my station. She takes my hand, her expression pitying.
I am only thinking of your future, Oriana says, voice still soft. Those close to the throne are seldom truly close to anyone else. A mortal girl would have even fewer allies.
I nod as though giving in to her wise advice. If she doesn't believe me, then the easiest thing is to go along with her. I guess it makes more sense than the truth, that Dane has selected me to be part of his nest of thieves and spies. Something about my expression causes her to catch both of my hands. I wince at the pressure on my wound.
Before I was Maddox's wife, I was one of the consorts to the King of Elfheim. Hear me, Jude. It is no easy thing to be the lover of the High King. It is to always be in danger. It is to always be a pawn. I must be gaping at her, as shocked as I am. I never wondered about her life before she came to us. Suddenly, Oriana's fears for us make a different kind of sense. She was used to playing by an entirely different set of rules. The floor seems to have tilted beneath my feet. I do not know the woman in front of me. Do not know what she suffered before coming to this house. No longer even know how she really came to be Maddox's wife. Did she love him? Or was she making a clever marriage to gain his protection? I didn't know, I say stupidly. I never gave Eldred a child, she tells me. But another of his lovers nearly did. When she died, rumor pointed to one of the princes poisoning her, just to prevent competition for the throne. Oriana watches my face with her pale pink eyes. I know she's talking about Lariope. You don't need to believe me. There are a dozen more rumors just as terrible. When there is a lot of power concentrated in one place, there are plenty of scraps to fight over. If the court isn't busy drinking poison, then it's drinking bile. You wouldn't be well suited to it.
What makes you think that? I ask, her words annoyingly close to Maddox when he dismissed my chances at knighthood. Maybe it would suit me just fine. Her fingers brush my face again, stroking back my hair. It should be a tender gesture, but it's an evaluating one instead.
He must have loved your mother very much, she says. He's besotted with you girls. If I were him, I would have sent you away a long time ago.
I don't doubt that.
If you go to Prince Dane, despite my warning, if he gets his heir on you, tell no one before you tell me. Swear it on your mother's grave.
I feel her nails as her hand comes to rest against the back of my neck and wince.
No one. Do you understand?
I promise. This is one vow I should have no trouble keeping. I try to give the words weight, so she'll believe I mean it. Seriously, I promise. She releases me.
You may go. Rest well, Jude. When you rise, the coronation will be upon us, and there will be little time left for resting.
I curtsy and take my leave. In the hall, Taryn is waiting for me. She sits on a bench carved with coiled serpents and swings her feet. As the door closes, she looks up.
What was going on with her?
I shake my head, trying to rid myself of a jumble of feelings.
Did you know she used to be the High King's consort?
Taryn's eyebrows go up, and she snorts, delighted.
No? Is that what she told you?
Pretty much. I think of Locke's mother and the singing bird in the acorn, of Eldred on his throne, head bowed by his own crown. It is hard for me to picture him taking lovers, no less the quantity he must have taken to have so many children. An unnatural number for a fairy. And yet, perhaps that's just a failure of my imagination.
Huh.
Taryn looks as though she's having the same failure of imagination. She frowns, puzzling for a moment, then seems to remember what she'd waited to ask me.
Do you know why Prince Baelkin was here?
He was here? I am not sure I can weather more surprises.
Here? In the house?
She nods.
He arrived with Maddox, and they were shut up in his office for hours.
I wonder how long they arrived after Prince Dane's departure. Hopefully, long enough for Prince Dane not to overhear anything about a missing servant. My hand throbs whenever I move it, but I am just glad I can move it at all. I am not eager to face any more punishment. And yet, Maddox didn't seem angry with me just now when he saw me with my dress. He seemed normal. Pleased, even. Perhaps they were conferring about other things. Weird, I say to Taryn. Because I am commanded not to tell her about being a spy, and I cannot bring myself to tell her about Sophie. I am glad that the coronation is nearly here. I want it to come and sweep everything else away. That night, I drowse in my bed, fully dressed, waiting for the ghost. I have bagged out on lessons for 2 nights straight. The night of Locke's party, and last night, searching the water for Sophie. He's bound to be annoyed when he comes. I put that as far out of my head as I can and concentrate on resting, breathing in and out. When I first came to Faerie, I had trouble sleeping. You'd think I'd have had nightmares, but I don't remember many. My dreams struggled to rival the horror of my actual life. Instead, I couldn't calm down enough to rest. I would toss and turn all night and all morning, my heart racing, finally falling into a headachy sleep in the late afternoon, when the rest of Faerie was just rising. I took to wandering the corridors of the house like a restless spirit, thumbing through ancient books, moving around the game pieces on the fox and geese board. toasting cheese in the kitchens, and staring at Maddox's blood-soaked cap, as though it contained the answers to the universe in its tied lines. One of the Hobbs who used to work here, Nell Uther, would find me and guide me back to my room, telling me that if I couldn't sleep, then I ought to just close my eyes and lie still, that at least my body could rest, even if my mind wouldn't. I am lying like that when I hear a rustling on the balcony. I turn, fully expecting to see the ghost. I'm about to tease him for actually making a sound, when I realize the person rattling the doors isn't the ghost at all. It's Valerian, and he has a long, curving knife in one hand, and a smile every bit as sharp, pulling at his mouth. What? I scramble into a sitting position. What are you doing here? I realize that I am whispering, as though I am afraid of his being discovered. You are my creature, Jude Duarte. You will strike only when I tell you to strike. Otherwise, stay your hand. At least Prince Dane didn't glamour me to obey those orders.
Why shouldn't I be here?
Valerian asks me, striding closer. He smells like pine sap and burned hair, and there is a light dusting of golden powder streaked over one cheek. I am not sure where he's been before this, but I don't think he's sober. This is my home. I am prepared for training with the ghost. I have a knife in my boot and another at my hip. But thinking of Dane's command, thinking of how not to disappoint him further, I reach for neither. I am flummoxed by Valerian's being here, in my room. He walks up to my bed. He's holding the knife well enough, but I can tell he's not particularly practiced with it. He is no general's son.
None of this is your home,
he tells me, voice shaking with anger. If Cardin put you up to this, you should really rethink your relationship, I say. Finally, now, afraid. By some miracle, my voice stays steady. Because if I scream, there are guards in the hall. They'll come. They've got big, pointy swords. Huge. Your friend is going to get you killed. Show your power by appearing powerless. He doesn't seem to be absorbing my words. His eyes are wild, red-rimmed, and not entirely focused on me.
Do you know what he said when I told him you'd stabbed me? He told me it was no more than I deserved.
That's impossible. Valerian must have misunderstood. Cardin must have been mocking him for letting me under his guard. What did you expect? I ask him, trying to hide my surprise. I don't know if you noticed, but the guy is a real jerk. If Valerian wasn't sure he wanted to stab me before, he's sure now. With a leap, he slams the blade into the mattress as I roll out of the way and onto my feet. Goose feathers fly up when he draws back the blade, drifting through the air like snow. He scrambles to his feet as I pull out a dagger of my own. Do not reveal your skill with a blade. Do not reveal your mastery over glamour. Do not reveal all that you can do. Little did Prince Dane know that my real skill lies in pissing people off. Valerian advances on me again. He's intoxicated and furious and not all that well trained. But he's one of the folk, born with their cat reflexes and blessed with height that gives him better reach. My heart is hammering in my chest. I should scream for help. I should scream. I open my mouth, and he lunges at me. The scream comes out as a woof of breath as I lose my balance. My shoulder hits the floor hard as I roll again. I am practiced enough that despite my surprise, I kick his knife hand when he comes toward me. The blade skitters across the floor. Okay, I say, as though I am trying to calm us both down. Okay. He doesn't pause. Even though I am holding a knife, Even though I've avoided his attacks twice and disarmed him. Even though I've stabbed him once before. He grabs for my throat again. His fingers sink into the flesh of my neck, and I remember how it felt to have fruit jammed into my mouth. Soft flesh parting against my teeth. I remember choking on nectar and pulp as the horrible bliss of the Everapple stole over me, robbing me of caring even that I was dying. He'd wanted to watch me die. Wanted to watch me fight for breath the way I am fighting for it now. I look into his eyes and find the same expression there. You are nothing. You barely exist at all. Your only purpose is to create more of your kind before you die. He's wrong about me. I am going to make my mayfly life count for something. I won't be afraid of him or of Prince Dane's censure. If I cannot be better than them, I will become so much worse. Despite his fingers against my windpipe, despite the way my vision has begun to go dark around the edges, I make sure of my strike before I drive my knife into his chest, into his heart. Valyrian rolls off me, making a gurgling sound. I suck in lungfuls of air. He tries to stand, sways, and falls back to his knees. Looking over at him dizzily, I see the hilt of my knife is sticking out of his chest. The red velvet of his doublet is turning a deeper, wetter red. He reaches for the blade as though to draw it out. Don't, I say automatically, because that will only make the wound worse. I grab for anything nearby. There is a discarded petticoat on the floor that I can use to staunch the blood. He slides down onto his side, away from me, and sneers, although he can barely open his eyes. You've got to let me, I start.
I curse you,
Valyrian whispers.
I curse you. 3 times, I curse you. As you've murdered me, may your hands always be stained with blood. May death be your only companion. May you...
He breaks off abruptly, coughing. When he stops, he doesn't stir. His eyes stay as they are, half-lidded, but the gleam has gone out of them. My wounded hand flies to cover my mouth in horror at the curse, as though to stop a scream, but I don't scream. I haven't screamed this whole time, and I am not going to start now, when there's nothing more to scream about. As minutes slip by, I just sit there beside Valyrian, watching the skin of his face grow paler as the blood no longer pumps to it. Watching his lips go a kind of greenish blue. He doesn't die very differently than mortals, although I am sure it would gall him to know that. He might have lived for 1,000 years if it wasn't for me. My hand hurts worse than ever. I must have banged it in the fight. I look around and catch my own reflection in the mirror across the room. A human girl. Hair tousled. Eyes feverish. A pool of blood forming at her feet. The ghost is coming. He'd know what to do with a dead body. He has certainly killed people before. But Prince Dane is already angry with me just for stabbing the child of a well-favored member of his court. Killing that same child the night before Dane's coronation won't go over well. The last people I need to know about this are the Court of Shadows. No. I need to hide the body myself. I scan the room, hoping for inspiration. But the only place I can think of that will even conceal him temporarily is beneath my bed. I spread the petticoat next to Valyrian's body and then roll him onto it. I feel a little queasy. His body is still warm. Ignoring that, I drag him over to the bed and push him and all the skirts under, first with my hands and then with my feet. Only a smear of blood remains. I get the pitcher of water near the bedpan and splashed some on the wooden planks of the floor, and then some on my face. My good hand is shaking as I finish wiping up, and I sink to the floor, both hands in my hair. I am not okay. I am not okay. I am not okay. But when the ghost arrives on my balcony, he can't tell. And that's the important thing.
Chapter 19. That night, the ghost shows me how to climb far higher than the landing where Taryn and I tarried the last time. We climb all the way up to the rafters above the Great Hall and perch on heavy wooden beams. They are coiled around with a lattice of roots, which sometimes form the shapes of cages, sometimes balconies, and sometimes would appear more like tight ropes. Beneath us, the preparations for the coronation go on. Blue velvet and hammered silver and braided gold tablecloths all rolled out, each one decorated with the House of Greenbrier standard, a tree of flowers, thorns, and roots. "Do you think things will be better after Prince Dane becomes the High King?" I ask him. The ghost gives me a vague smile and shakes his head sadly.
"Things will always be as they always are," he tells me. "Only more so."
I don't know what that means, but it's a fey enough answer that I figure I am unlikely to get more out of him. I think of Valyrian's body under my bed. The folk do not rot the way mortals do. Sometimes their bodies grow over with lichen or bloom with mushrooms. I've heard stories about battlefields turning into green hills. I wish I could go back and find that he turned into mulch. But I doubt I will be that lucky. I shouldn't be thinking about his body. I should be thinking about him. I should be worrying over more than getting caught. We walk across roots and beams, unnoticed, jumping silently high above swarms of liveried servants. I turn to the ghost, watching his calm face and the expert way he places each foot. I try to do the same. I try not to use my sore hand for anything more than balance. He seems to notice, but he doesn't ask. Maybe he already knows what happened.
"Now wait,"
he says as we settle onto a heavy beam. "For anything in particular?" I ask.
"I have word that a messenger is coming from Balkin's estate, disguised in the High King's livery," he says. "We're to kill it before it enters the royal quarters."
The ghost says this without particular emotion. I wonder how long he has worked for Dane. I wonder if Dane ever asked him to drive a knife through his palm, if he tested them all that way, or if that was a special test, just for mortals. "Is the messenger going to assassinate Prince Dane?" I ask.
"Let's not find out," he says.
Below me, spun sugar creations are being finished off with high crystalline spires. Apples painted with Nevermore are piled on the banquet tables in such quantity as to send half the court dreaming. I think of Cardin's mouth, flaked with gold. "Are you sure they're coming this way?"
"I am,"
he says, and no more than that. So we wait, and I try not to fidget as minutes slide into hours, moving just enough to keep my muscles from stiffening. This is part of my training. Probably the aspect the ghost thinks is most essential after slyfooting. He has told me again and again that most of being a killer and a thief is waiting. The hardest thing, according to him, is not letting your mind drift to other things. He seems to be right. Up here, watching the ebb and flow of the servants, my thoughts turn to the coronation, to the drowned girl, to Cardin riding up on his horse as I flood Hollow Hall, to Valyrian's frozen, dying smile. I wrench my thoughts back to the present. Beneath me, a creature with a long, hairless tail that drags in the dirt scuttles across the ground. For a moment, I think it is part of the kitchen staff. But the bag it carries is too filthy,
and there's something subtly wrong with its livery. It isn't dressed like one of Baelkin's servants, and neither is its uniform the same as the other palace staff. I glance over at the ghost.
Good,
he says.
Now shoot.
My hands feel sweaty as I draw out the miniature crossbow, seeking to steady it against my arm. I have grown up in a house of butchery. I have trained for this. My principal childhood memory is of bloodshed. I have killed already tonight. And yet, for a moment, I am not sure I can do it.
You're no killer.
I take a breath and loose the bolt. My arm spasms from the recoil. The creature topples over, a flailing arm sending a pyramid of golden apples spilling to the dirt. I press myself down against a thick cluster of roots, camouflaging myself as I've been taught. Servants scream, looking around for the shooter. Next to me, the ghost has a smile on the corner of his mouth.
Was that your first?
He asks me. And then when I look at him blankly, he clarifies.
Have you ever killed anyone before?
May death be your only companion. I shake my head, not trusting myself to speak the lie out loud convincingly.
Sometimes mortals throw up or cry,
he says, clearly pleased I am doing neither of those things.
It shouldn't shame you.
I feel fine, I say, taking a deep breath and fitting a new bolt into the bow. What I feel is a kind of nervous, adrenaline-soaked readiness. I seem to have passed some kind of threshold. Before, I never knew how far I would go. Now I believe I have the answer. I will go as far as there is to go. I will go way too far. He raises both brows.
You're good at this. Nice marksmanship and a stomach for violence.
I am surprised. The ghost is not given to compliments. I have vowed to become worse than my rivals. Two murders completed in a single night mark a descent I should be proud of. Maddock could not have been more wrong about me.
Most of the children of the gentry don't have the patience, he says, and they're not used to getting their hands dirty.
I do not know what to say to that, with Valyrian's curse fresh in my mind. Maybe there's something broken in me from watching my parents being murdered. Maybe my messed up life turned me into someone capable of doing messed up things. But another part of me wonders if I was raised by Maddock in the family business of bloodshed. Am I like this because of what he did to my parents? Or because he was my parent? May your hands always be stained with blood. The ghost reaches out to grab my wrist, and before I can snatch it back, he points to the pale half-moons at the base of my nails.
Speaking of hands, I can see what you've been doing in the discoloration of your fingers. The blue cast. I can smell it in your sweat, too. You've been poisoning yourself.
I swallow, and then, because there's no reason to deny it, I nod.
Why?
The thing I like about the ghost is that I can tell he's not asking to set me up for a lecture. He just seems curious. I'm not sure how to explain it. Being mortal means I have to try harder. The ghost studies my face.
Someone's really sold you a bill of goods. Plenty of mortals are better at plenty of stuff than the folk. Why do you think we steal them away?
It takes me a moment to realize he's serious. So I could be... I can't finish the sentence.
He snorts. Better than me? Don't press your luck.
That's not what I was going to say, I protest. But he only grins. I look down. The body is still lying there. A few knights have gathered around it. As soon as they move the body, we will move too. I just need to be able to vanquish my enemies. That's all. He looks surprised.
Do you have a lot of enemies, then?
I am sure he imagines me among the children of the gentry, with their soft hands and velvet skirts. He thinks of little cruelties, small slights, minor snubs. Not many, I say, thinking of the lazy, hateful look Cardin gave me by torchlight in the hedge maze. But their quality. When the knights finally bear the body away and no one is searching for us anymore, the ghost leads me across the roots again. We slip through corridors until he can get close enough to the messenger bag to light finger the papers inside. Up close, though, I realize something that chills my blood. The messenger was disguised. The creature is female, and while her tail is fake, her long parsnip nose is entirely real. She's one of Maddox's spies. The ghost tucks the note into his jacket and doesn't unroll it until we're out in the woods, with only moonlight to see by. When he looks, though, his expression turns stony. He's gripping the paper so hard it's crinkling in his fingers. "What does it say?" I ask. He turns the page toward me. There, six words are scrawled. "Kill the bearer of this message." "What does that mean?" I ask, feeling sick. The ghost shakes his head.
"It means that Bill can set us up. Come on, we need to go."
He pulls me along into the shadows, and together we slink away. I do not tell the ghost that I thought she worked for Matic. Instead, I try to puzzle through things myself. But I have too few pieces. What does the murder of Lariope have to do with the coronation? What does Matic have to do with any of this? Could his spy have been a double agent, working for Baelkin as well as Matic? If so, does that mean she was stealing information from my household?
"Someone is trying to distract us," the ghost says. "While they set their trap, be alert tomorrow."
The ghost doesn't give me any more specific orders, doesn't even tell me to stop taking my tiny doses of poison. He doesn't direct me to do anything differently. He leads me home to catch scraps of sleep just after dawn. As we're about to part, I want to stop and throw myself on his mercy. "I've done a terrible thing," I want to say. "Help me with the body. Help me." But we all want stupid things. That doesn't mean we should have them. I bury Valerian near the stables, but outside the paddock, so that even the most carnivorous of Maddox's sharp-toothed horses are unlikely to dig him up and gnaw on his bones. It's not easy to bury a body. It's especially not easy to bury a body without your whole household finding out. I must roll Valerian onto my balcony and hurl him into the brush below. Then, one-handed, I must drag him away from the house. I am straining and sweating by the time I get to a likely plot of dew-covered grass. Newly woken birds call to one another beneath the brightening sky. For a moment, all I want to do is lie down myself. But I still have to dig. The next afternoon is a sleep-deprived blur of being painted and braided, corseted and cinched. Three fat gold earrings run up the side of one of Maddox's green ears, and he wears long gold claws over his fingers. Oriana looks like a rose in bloom beside him, wearing a massive necklace of rough-cut green emeralds at her throat, large enough to nearly count as armor. In my room, I unwrap my hand. It looks worse than I had hoped. Wet and sticking, instead of scabbed over. Swollen. I finally take Dane's advice and get some moss from the kitchens, wash the wound, and re-wrap it with my makeshift button brace. I wasn't planning to wear gloves to the coronation, but I don't have much choice. Hunting around in my drawers, I find a set in a dark blue silk and draw them on. I imagine Locke taking my hands tonight. Imagine him sweeping me around the hill. I hope I can avoid flinching if he presses on my palm.
I can never let him guess what happened to Valerian. No matter how much he likes me, he wouldn't like kissing the person who put his friend in the ground. My sisters and I pass one another in the hall as we dart around, grabbing stray things we need. Vivienne goes through my jewelry cabinet, finding nothing adequately matching her ghostly dress in her own. You're actually coming with us, I say. Maddock will be stunned. I am wearing a choker to cover the bruises blooming on my throat, where Valerian's fingers sank into my skin. When Vivi gets down on her knees to sort through a tangle of earrings, I have a terror that she will glance beneath my bed and see some smear of blood I have missed cleaning. I am so worried that I barely register her smile.
I like to keep everyone on their toes, she says. Besides, I want to gossip with Princess Raya and see the spectacle of so many rulers of fairy courts in one place. But most of all, I want to meet Taryn's mysterious suitor and see what Maddock makes of his proposal.
Do you have any idea who it is? I ask. With everything that's happened, I had nearly forgotten about him.
Not even a guess. Do you?
She finds what she is looking for. Iridescent gray labradorite drops given to me by Taryn for my 16th birthday. Forged by a goblin tinker with whom she traded 3 kisses. In idle moments, I have turned over and over who might ask for her hand. I think of the way Cardin pulled her aside and made her cry. I think of Lyrian's leer. Of the way she shoved me too hard when I teased her about Balkan, although I am almost certain it isn't him. My head swims, and I want to lie back down on the bed and close my eyes. Please, please let it be none of them. Let it be someone nice we don't know. I remind myself of what she said. I think he would like him. Turning to Vivi, I'm about to start making a list of safer possibilities when Maddock comes into the room. He's holding a slim, silver-sheathed blade in one hand.
Vivienne,
he says with a little dip of his head.
Could you give me a moment with Jude here?
Sure, Daddy.
She says with small, poisonous emphasis as she slips out with my earrings. He clears his throat a little awkwardly and holds the silver sword out to me. The guard and pommel are unadorned, elegantly shaped. The blade is etched along the fuller with a barely visible pattern of vines.
I have something I'd like you to wear tonight. It's a gift.
I think I make a little gasp. It's a really, really, really pretty sword.
You've been training so diligently that I knew it should be yours. Its maker called it Nightfell. But of course you are welcome to call it anything you like or nothing at all. It's said to bring the wielder luck, but everyone says that about swords, don't they? It's something of a family heirloom.
Oriana's words come back to me. He's besotted with you girls. He must have loved your mother very much. But what about Oak? I blurt out. What if he wants it? Maddock gives me a small smile.
Do you want it?
Yes, I say, unable to help myself. When I pull it from its sheath, it comes as though made for my hand. The balance is perfect. Yes, of course I do.
That's good. Because this is your sword by right, forged for me by your father, Justin Duarte. He's the one who crafted it, the one who named it. It's your family heirloom.
I am momentarily robbed of breath. I have never heard my father's name spoken aloud by Maddock before. We do not talk about the fact that he murdered my parents. We talk around it. We certainly don't talk about when they were alive. My father made this, I say carefully, to be sure. My father was here. In Faerie?
Yes, for several years. I only have a few pieces of his. I found 2. One for you, and one for Taryn.
He grimaces.
This is where your mother met him. Then they ran away together, back to the mortal world.
I take a shuddering breath, finding the courage to ask a question I have often wondered, but never dared voice aloud. What were they like? I flinch as the words leave my mouth. I don't even know if I want him to tell me. Sometimes, I just want to hate her. If I can hate her, then it won't be so bad that I love him. But, of course, she's still my mother. The only thing I can truly be angry with her for is being gone. And that's certainly not her fault. Maddox sits down on the goat-footed stool in front of my dressing table and stretches out his bad leg, looking for all the world as though he's about to tell me a bedtime story.
She was clever, your mother. And young. After I brought her to Ferry, she drank and danced weeks away at a time. She was at the center of every revel. I could not always accompany her. There was a war in the East, an unseelie king with a lot of territory, and no desire to bend his knee to the High King. But I drank in her happiness when I was here. She had a way of making everyone around her feel as though every impossible thing was possible. I suppose I put it down to her mortality, but I don't think I was being fair. It was something else. Her daring, perhaps? She never seemed cowed. Not by any of the magic. Not by anything.
I thought he might be angry, but he obviously isn't. In fact, his voice holds a totally unexpected fondness. I sit down on the bench in front of my bed, holding on to my new silver sword for support.
Your father was interesting. I imagine you think I didn't know him, but he came to my house. My old house. The one they burned down. Many times. We drank honey wine in the gardens, the three of us. He loved swords, he said, from the time he was a child. When he was around your age, he persuaded his parents to allow him to build his first forge in their backyard. Instead of going to college, he found a master swordsmith to take him on as an apprentice. From there, he got himself introduced to an assistant curator in a museum. She snuck him in after hours, allowing him to see ancient swords up close and honing his craft. But then he heard about the kinds of blades that could be wrought only by the Fae. So he came looking for us. He was a master smith when he came here, and even better when he left. But he couldn't resist bragging about stealing our secrets, along with his bride. Eventually, the tale came to Baelkin, who gave it to me.
If my father had really talked with Matic, he ought to have known better than to brag about stealing from him. But I have stood on the streets of the mortal world and felt how far it seems from Elfheim. As the years passed, his time in Ferry must have seemed like a distant dream.
There is little good in me,
Matic says.
But I owe you a debt, and I have sworn to do the best by you that I know how. After today, things will be different,
he tells me.
I will wait for you in the carriage.
He leaves me. I hold my head. My thoughts will not focus. When I rise, though, I strap on my new sword. It is cold and solid in my hands, heavy as a promise. Chapter 20. Oak is in cricket green,
dancing around in front of the carriage. When he sees me, he runs over, wanting me to carry him. Then he runs off to pet the horses before I can. He is a fairy child, with a fairy child's whims. Taryn is beautiful in her heavily embroidered dress, and Vivi radiant in soft velvet gray with artfully sewn moths, seeming to fly from her shoulder across her chest to gather in another group on one side of her waist. I realize how rarely I've seen her in truly splendid clothes. Her hair is up, and my earrings glitter in her lightly furred ears. Her cat eyes gleam in the half-light, twin to Maddox. For once, that makes me smile. I take Taryn's hand with my undamaged one, and she squeezes it hard. We grin at each other. Conspirators for once. In the carriage, there is a hamper of things to eat, which was smart of someone, because none of us has remembered to eat enough all day. I remove a glove and eat two small rolls of bread, so light and filled with air that they seem to dissolve on my tongue. At the center of each is a mass of honeyed raisins and nuts. Their sweetness, enough to bring tears to my eyes. Maddox passes me a slab of pale yellow cheese and a still bloody slice of juniper and pepper-crusted venison. We make quick work of the food. I spot Maddox's red cap, half in and half out of his front pocket. His version of a medal, I suppose, to be worn on state occasions. None of us really speaks. I do not know what the others dwell on, but abruptly, I realize I am going to have to dance. I am terrible at dancing, since I have no practice in it other than humiliating lessons at school, partnered with Taryn. I think of the ghost and the roach and the bomb, trying to safeguard Dane against whatever Baelkin has planned. I wish I knew what to do, how to help them. Kill the bearer of this message. I look over at Maddox, drinking spiced wine. He seems entirely comfortable, totally unaware of, or unconcerned with, the loss of one of his spies. My heartbeat drums faster. I keep remembering not to wipe my hand on my skirts for fear of smearing them with food. Eventually, Oriana pulls out some handkerchiefs soaked in rose and mint water for us to wipe ourselves down with. This sets off a chase, with Oak trying to avoid being washed. There isn't far for him to run in the carriage, but he keeps it going longer than you'd think, stepping on all of us in the process. I'm so distracted, I don't even automatically brace when we go straight through the rock and into the palace. We're lurching to a stop before I even notice we've arrived. A footman opens the door, and I see the whole courtyard filled with music and voices and merriment. And candles, forests of them. The wax melting to create an effect like termite-eaten wood. Candles rest atop tree branches. Flames flickering with the whoosh of dresses sweeping below. They line the walls like sentries and clump in tight arrangements on stones, lighting up the hill.
Ready? Taryn whispers to me.
Yes, I say a little breathlessly. We pile out of the carriage. Oriana has a little silver leash she attaches to Oak's wrist, which strikes me as not the worst idea, although he whines and sits in the dirt in protest like a cat. Vivienne looks around the courtyard. There's something feral in her gaze. Her nose flares.
Are we supposed to present ourselves to the High King one last time? She asks Maddox.
He gives a half shake of his head.
No, we will be called forth when it is time to take our oaths. Until then, I must stand beside Prince Dane. The rest of you should go enjoy yourselves until the bells chime and Val Morin begins the ceremony. Then, come to the throne room to witness the coronation. I'd have you close to the dais, where my knights can look after you.
I turn toward Oriana, expecting another speech about not getting into trouble, or even a new speech about keeping my legs closed around royalty.
but she is too busy pleading with Oak to get out of the road.
Let's party, Vivi says, sweeping Taryn and me along with her.
We escape into the crowd, and moments later, we are drowning in it. The Palace of Elfheim is packed with bodies. The unallied wild fae, courtiers, and monarchs mingle together. Selkies from Queen Orla's court of the undersea speak together in their own language, skins slung from their shoulders like capes. I spot the lord of the court of termites, Roibin, who is said to have killed his own lover to win a throne. He stands near one of the long trestle tables, and even in the cramped hall, there is space around him, as though no one dares get too close. His hair is the color of salt, his garments entirely black, and a deadly curved sword sits at his hip. Incongruously, beside him, a green-skinned pixie girl is dressed in what appears to be a pearl-gray slip dress and heavy lace-up boots, obviously mortal clothes. And standing on either side of the pixie are two knights in his livery, one with scarlet hair braided into a crown on her head, Dulcamera, who lectured us on the crown. There are others, figures I have heard of in ballads. Rue Silver of New Avalon, who cut her island out of the California coast, is talking to the exiled Alder King's son, Severin, who might try to ally with the new High King, or might join Lord Roibin's court. He's with a red-haired human boy about my age, which makes me pause to study them. Is the boy his servant? Is he enchanted? I can't tell just from the way he looks around the room. But when he sees me staring, he grins. I turn quickly away. As I do, the Selkies shift, and I spot someone else with them. Gray-skinned and blue-lipped, hair hanging around her sunken-eyed face. But despite all that, I recognize her. Sophie. I had heard stories about the merfolk of the undersea keeping drowned sailors. But I didn't believe them. When her mouth moves, I see that she has sharp teeth. A shudder ripples across my shoulders. I stumble along after Vivi and Taryn. When I look back, I don't see Sophie, and I am not entirely sure I didn't imagine her. We slide past a shag foal and a bar guest. Everyone is laughing too loudly, dancing too fiercely. As I pass one reveler in a goblin mask, he lifts it and winks at me. It's the roach.
Heard about the other night?
Good work, he says.
Now keep your eyes out for anything that seems amiss. If Belkin's going to move against Dane, he's going to do it before the ceremony starts.
I will, I say, pulling free of my sisters to tarry with him a moment. In a crowd this size, it's easy to be briefly lost.
Good. Came to see Prince Dane win the crown with my own eyes.
He reaches into his leaf-brown jacket and pulls out a silver flask, popping the top and taking a swig.
Plus watching the gentry cavort and make fools out of themselves.
He holds the flask out to me with one gray-green clawed hand. Even from there, I can smell whatever is inside. Pungent and strong, and a little swampy. I'm okay, I say, shaking my head.
You sure are,
he tells me, laughing, and then pulls down his mask again. I am left grinning after him as he sweeps away into the crowd. Just seeing him has filled me with a sense of finally belonging to this place. He and the ghost and the bomb are not precisely my friends, but they actually seem to like me, and I am not inclined to split hairs. I have a place with them and a purpose.
Where have you been?
Vivienne asks, grabbing hold of me.
You need a leash like Oak's. Come on, we're going to dance.
I eddy along with them. There's music everywhere, urging a lightness of step. They say the pull of fairy music is impossible to resist, which isn't quite true. What's impossible is to stop dancing once you've begun, so long as the music goes on.
And it does. All night. One dance bleeding into the next. One song becoming another, without a pause to catch your breath. It's exhilarating to be caught up in the music, to be swept away in the tide of it. Of course, Vivi, being one of them, can stop whenever she wants. She can also yank us out, so dancing with her is almost safe. Not that Vivi always remembers to do the safe thing. But really, I am the last person to judge anyone for that. We clasp hands and join the circle dance, leaping and laughing. The song feels as though it is calling my blood, moving it through my veins to the same ragged beat, with the same sweet chords. The circle breaks up, and somehow I am holding Locke's hands. He sweeps me around in a giddy whoosh.
"You are beautiful," he says, "like a winter night."
He smiles down at me with his fox eyes. His russet hair curls around his pointed ears. From one lobe, a golden earring dangles, catching the candlelight like a mirror. He's the one who's beautiful. A kind of breathless, inhuman beauty.
"I'm glad you like the dress," I manage. "Tell me, could you love me?"
he asks, seemingly out of nowhere.
"Of course."
I laugh, not sure of the answer I'm supposed to give. But the question is so oddly phrased that I can hardly deny him. I love my parents' murderer. I suppose I could love anyone. I'd like to love him.
"I wonder," he says, "what would you do for me?"
"I don't know what you mean." This riddling figure with flinty eyes isn't the Locke who stood on the rooftop of his estate and spoke so gently to me, or who chased me, laughing through its halls. I am not quite sure who this Locke is, but he has put me entirely off balance.
"Would you forswear a promise for me?"
He is smiling at me as though he's teasing. "What promise?" He sweeps me around him, my leather slippers pirouetting over the packed earth. In the distance, a piper begins to play.
"Any promise,"
he says lightly, although it is no light thing he is asking. "I guess it depends," I say, because the real answer, a flat no, isn't what anyone wants to hear.
"Do you love me enough to give me up?"
I am sure my expression is stricken. He leans closer.
"Isn't that a test of love?"
I don't know, I say. All this must be leading up to some declaration on his part, either of affection or of a lack of it.
"Do you love me enough to weep over me?"
The words are spoken against my neck. I can feel his breath, making the tiny hairs stand up, making me shudder with an odd combination of desire and discomfort.
"You mean if you were hurt?" "I mean, if I hurt you."
My skin prickles. I don't like this, but at least I know what to say. If you hurt me, I wouldn't cry. I would hurt you back. His step falters as we sweep over the floor.
"I'm sure you'd."
And then he breaks off speaking, looking behind him. I can barely think. My face is hot. I dread what he will say next.
"Time to change partners,"
a voice says. And I look to see that it's the worst person possible. Carden.
"Oh,"
he says to Locke.
"Did I steal your line?"
His tone is unfriendly, and as I turn his words over in my mind, they do little to comfort me. Locke relinquishes me to the youngest prince, as is expected out of deference. I see out of the corner of my eye that Taryn is watching us. She's standing frozen in the middle of the revel, looking lost, as fairies swarm around her, swinging their partners in dizzying spirals. I wonder if Carden bothered her before he bothered me. He takes my wounded hand in his. He's wearing black gloves, the leather warm even through the silk over my fingers.
and a black suit of clothes. Raven feathers cover the upper half of his doublet, and his boots have excessively pointed metal toes that make me conscious of how easy it will be to kick me savagely once we've begun dancing. At his brow, he wears a crown of woven metal branches, cocked slightly askew. Dark silver paint streaks over his cheekbones, and black lines run along his lashes. The left one is smeared, as though he forgot about it and wiped his eye. "What do you want?" I ask him, forcing the words out. I am still thinking about Locke, still reeling from what he said and what he didn't. "Go ahead, insult me." His eyebrows go up.
"I don't take commands from mortals," he says, with his customary cruel smile.
"So you're going to say something nice?" "I don't think so. Fairies can't lie."
I want to be angry, but what I feel right now is gratitude. My face is no longer flaming, and my eyes aren't stinging. I'm ready to fight, which is far better, though I am sure it's the last thing he meant. He did me an enormous favor when he whisked me away from Locke.
His hand slides lower on my hip. I narrow my eyes at him.
"You really hate me, don't you?"
he asks, his smile growing. "Almost as much as you hate me," I say, thinking of the page with my name scratched on it. Thinking of the way he looked at me when he was drunk in the hedge maze. The way he's looking at me now. He lets go of my hand.
"Until we spar again,"
he says, making a bow that I cannot help feel is nothing but mockery. I look after him as he weaves unsteadily through the crowd, not sure what to make of that conversation. Bells begin to ring, signaling the start of the ceremony. The musicians quiet their fiddles and harps. For a long moment, the hill is silent, listening, and then people move to their places. I push toward the front, where the rest of the gentry of the High King's Court are assembling, where my family will be. Oriana is there already, standing beside one of Maddox's best knights and looking as though she wishes she could be anywhere else. Oak is off his leash and on Taryn's shoulders. She is whispering something to a laughing Locke. I stop moving. The crowd surges around me, but I am rooted to the spot as Taryn leans in and tucks a stray bit of hair behind Locke's ear. There is so much in that small gesture. I try to make myself believe it means nothing, but after the strange conversation we had, I can't. But Taryn has a lover, one who is going to ask for her hand tonight, and she knows that Locke and I are whatever we are. "Do you love me enough to give me up? Isn't that a test of love?" Vivienne has come out of the crowd, cat eyes agleam, hair loose around her face. She takes Oak in her arms and swings him around and around until they both fall in a whoosh of Vivi's skirts. I should go over, but I don't. I can't face Taryn yet. Not when I cannot get such a disloyal thought out of my head. Instead, I hang back, watching the royal family assemble on the dais. The High King is seated on his throne of woven branches, wearing the heavy circlet, looking out from his deeply lined face with alert bronze eyes, like those of an owl. Prince Dane sits on a humble wooden stool beside him, dressed in all white robes, his feet and hands bare, and behind the throne stands the rest of the royal family, Baelkin and Elowyn, Rhaya and Kalia. Even Taniot, Prince Dane's mother, is present, in a garment of shining gold. The only family member missing is Cardin. The High King Eldred stands, and the entire hill goes quiet.
"Long has been my rule, but today I take my leave of you."
His voice echoes through the hill. Rarely has he ever spoken this way, to a great assemblage of us. and I am struck both by the power of his voice and the frailness of his person.
When first I felt the call to search out the land of promise, I believed it would pass, but I can resist it no longer. Today, I will be king no more, but wanderer.
Although everyone here must know this was what we've gathered for, still there are cries from all around me. A sprite begins to weep into the hair of a goat-headed Fuka. The court poet and seneschal, Val Morin, steps from the side of the dais. He is stooped, spindly, his long hair full of sticks, with a scold crow perched on one shoulder. He leans heavily on a staff of smooth wood that has begun to bud at the very top, as though it were still alive. He is rumored to have been lured away from the mortal land to Eldred's bed in his youth. I wonder what he will do now, without his king.
"We are loath to let you go, my lord,"
he says, and the words seem to take on a special, bittersweet resonance coming from his mouth. Eldred cups his hands, and the branches of the throne shudder and begin to grow, sending up new green shoots to spiral into the air, leaves unfurling and flower buds bursting along the length of them. The roots of the ceiling begin to worm, lengthening like vines and crawling across the underside of the hill. There is a scent in the air, like a summer breeze, heavy with the promise of apples.
"Another will stand in my place. I ask of you, release me."
The assembled folk speak as one, surprising me. "We release you," they say, words echoing around me. The High King lets his heavy robe of state fall from his shoulders. It crumples on the stone in a jewel-encrusted pile. He takes the oak leaf crown from his own head. Already, he stands up straighter. There is an unnerving eagerness in him. Eldred has been the High King of Elfheim longer than the memories of many of the folk. He has always seemed ancient to me, but the years seem to fall from him, along with the mantle of rule.
"Whom will you put in your stead to be our High King?"
Valmorin asks.
"My third-born, my son, Dane," says Eldred. "Come forward, child."
Prince Dane rises from his humble place on the stool. His mother removes the white cloth covering him, leaving him naked. I blink once. I am used to a certain amount of nakedness in Faerie, but not among the royal family. Standing next to the rest of them in their heavy brocade and embroidered magnificence, he looks exquisitely vulnerable. I wonder if he's cold. I think of my hurt hand, and hope so.
"Will you accept?" Valmorin asks.
The scald crow on his shoulder lifts black-tipped wings and beats the air. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be part of the ceremony.
"I will assume the burden and the honor of the crown,"
Dane says gravely. And in that moment, his nakedness becomes something else. Some sign of power.
"I will have it. Unseelie Court, Knight Host, come forward and anoint your prince,"
Valmorin says. A bogan makes her hulking way to the raised dais. Her body is covered in thick golden hair, her arms long enough to drag on the ground if she didn't bend them. She looks strong enough to break Prince Dane in half. Around her waist, she wears a skirt of patchwork furs, and in one massive hand, she carries what looks like an inkpot. She paints his left arm with long spirals of clotting blood, paints it over his stomach, down his left leg. He does not flinch. When she is done, she steps back to admire her grisly handiwork, and then gives a shallow bow to Eldred.
"Seelie Court, Twilight Folk, come forward and anoint your prince,"
Valmorin says.
a diminutive boy in a wrapper of what looks like birch bark, his wild hair sticking up at odd angles, walks to the dais. Small, pale green wings sit on his back. When he anoints Dane's other side, he paints it in thick swaths of pollen, yellow as butter.
Wild Fae, shy folk, come forward and anoint your prince, says Valmorin.
It is a Hob who comes forward this time, in a dapper little suit, carefully sewn. He carries with him a handful of mud, which he smears over the center of Prince Dane's chest, just above his heart. I finally spot Cardan in the crowd, unsteady on his feet and with a wineskin in one hand. He appears to have gotten himself riotously drunk. When I think of the smear of silver paint on his face and the way his hand had slid on my hip, I guess he was well on his way there when I saw him. I feel an immense, mean satisfaction that he is not standing with the royal family at the most important moment for the court in centuries. He's going to be in so much trouble.
Who will clothe him?
Valmorin asks, and in turn, each of his sisters, and then his mother, bring him a white tunic and pants made from hide, a collar of gold, and high kidskin boots. He looks like a storybook king, one who will have a wise and just rule. I imagine the ghost in the rafters, and the roach in his mask watching proudly. I feel some of that same pride, being sworn to him. But I cannot forget his words to me. You are my creature, Jude Duarte. I touch my wounded hand to the hilt of my silver sword, the sword my father forged. After tonight, I will be the High King's spy and a true member of his court. I will lie to his enemies and, if that doesn't work, I will find a way to do something worse. And if he crosses me, well, then I will find a way around that too. Valmorin brings the end of his staff down hard against the ground, and I feel the reverberation to my teeth.
And who will crown him?
Eldred wears an expression of pride. The crown gleams in his gnarled hands, glowing as if sunlight emanated from the metal itself.
I will.
The guards are changing configuration subtly, perhaps preparing to escort Eldred out of the palace. There are more knights at the edges of the crowd than there were when the coronation ceremony began. The High King speaks.
Come, Dane, kneel before me.
The crown prince bends down in front of his father and the assemblage. My gaze cuts to Taryn, who is still standing with Locke. Orianna has a protective arm around Oak, one of Maddox's lieutenants bending to speak with her. He gestures toward a doorway, and she says something to Vivi and then starts toward it. Taryn and Locke follow. I grit my teeth and start to push my way through the crowd to them. I don't want to disgrace myself like Cardan by not being where I'm supposed to be. Valmorin's voice cuts through my thoughts.
And will you, the folk of Elfheim, accept Prince Dane as your High King?
The cry rose up from the crowd in chirping voices and bellows. We will! My gaze goes to the night surrounding the dais. In another life, I would have been one of them. But as my eyes rest there, I notice familiar faces. Maddox's best commanders. Warriors who are fiercely loyal. They are not dressed in their uniforms. Over shining armor, they wear the greenbrier livery. Perhaps Maddox is only being careful, only putting his best people in place. But the spy I killed, the one with the taunting message, was Maddox as well. And Orianna, Oak, and my sisters are gone, escorted out of the hill by one of Maddox's lieutenants, just as the dais became more heavily guarded. I have a plan to ensure our futures. I need to find the roach. I need to find the ghost. I need to tell them that something's wrong. A well-seasoned strategist waits for the right opportunity.
I push past a trio of goblins and a troll and one of the still folk. A spriggan growls at me, but I don't pay any mind. The end of the coronation is in sight. I see goblets and tankards being refilled. Up on the dais, Baelkin has left his place with the other princes and princesses. For a moment, I think it's part of the ceremony. Until he draws a long, thin blade. One I recognize from his horrible duel with Cardin. I stop moving.
Brother,
Prince Dane admonishes.
I will not accept you,
Baelkin says.
I have come to challenge you for the crown.
All around the dais, I see knights unsheathing blades. But neither Elowyn nor Eldred, nor any of the rest of them, not Valmorin, nor Taniot, nor Rhaya, is equipped. Only Kalia pulls out a knife from her bodice, the blade too small to be of much use. I want to draw my own sword, but everyone is pressed in too tightly.
Baelkin,
Eldred says sternly.
Child, the High Court cannot be like the lower courts. We have no blood inheritance. No duel with your brother will induce me to place a crown on your unworthy head. Content yourself with my choice. Do not humiliate yourself before all of Faerie.
This ought only be between us,
Baelkin says to Dane, not acknowledging that his father had even spoken.
There is no High Monarch now. There is no one but us and a crown.
I need not fight you,
Dane says, gesturing out toward the knights grouped thickly around the dais, waiting for an order. Madoc is among them, but I am not close enough to see more than that.
And you are not worthy of even that much regard.
Then have this on your conscience.
Baelkin walks two steps and thrusts out his arm. He doesn't even look in the direction he's thrusting, but his blade pierces Elowyn's throat. Someone shrieks. Then everyone does. For a moment, the wound is just a blotch against her skin, and then blood pours out, a river of red. She staggers forward, going to her hands and knees. Gold fabric and glittering gems are drowning in scarlet. It was a mere flick of Baelkin's blade, an almost nonchalant gesture. Eldred's hand comes up. I think he means to conjure up the same magic that made the roots grow, made the branches of the throne bloom and twine. But that power is gone. He gave it up with his kingdom. Instead, the newly budded flowers of the throne brown and wither. The crow on Valmorin's shoulder takes to wing, cawing as it flies toward the roots hanging down from the hollow roof of the hill.
Guards,
Dane says, in a voice that expects to be obeyed. None of the knights advance toward the dais, though. As one, they turn, so their backs are to the royal family and their swords to the assemblage. They're allowing this to happen, allowing Baelkin to stage his coup. But I cannot believe that this is in Madoc's plan. Dane is his friend. Dane campaigned with him. Dane is going to reward him once he's the High King. The crowd surges, carrying me with it. Everyone is moving, pushing forward or away from the gruesome tableau. I see the salt-haired king of the Court of Termites try to wade toward the fight, but his own knights get in front of him, holding him back. My family is gone. I look around for Cardin, but he is lost in the crowd. It is all happening so fast. Kalia has run to the High King's side. She has her small knife, barely long enough to be a weapon, but she holds it bravely. Taniot crouches over Elowyn's body, trying to stem the tide of blood with the skirts of her dress.
What do you say now, father?
Baelkin demands.
Brother?
Two bolts fly from the shadows, thudding into Baelkin's side. He staggers forward. The cloth of his doublet appears ripped, a gleam of metal underneath. Armor. I scan the rafters for the ghost. I am an agent of the prince as surely as he is. It's my duty to get to Dane. I shove forward again. In my head, I can see a vision of the future. Like a story I am telling myself. A clear, shining narrative to contrast with the chaos around me. Somehow, I will get to the prince and defend him against Baelkin's treachery until the loyal members of his guard reach us. I will be the hero, the one who put herself between the traitors and her king. Madoc gets there before I do. For a brief moment, I am relieved. His commander's loyalty might be bought, but Madoc would never. Then Madoc thrusts his sword through Dane's chest with such force that the blade emerges on the other side. He drags it up through his rib cage to his heart. I stop moving and let the crowd flow around me. I am still as stone. I see a flash of white bone, of wet red muscle. Prince Dane, who was almost the High King, falls on top of the gem-crusted red cloak of state, his spilling blood lost in the jumble of jewels.
Traitors,
Eldred whispers, but his voice is amplified by the space. The word feels as though it rings through the hall. Madoc pauses and then sets his jaw, as though he is doing some grim duty. He is wearing his red cap now, the one I saw sticking out of his pocket, the one I have studied in its case. Tonight, he will freshen it. There will be new tied lines. But I cannot believe he is doing this on anyone's orders. He must have allied with Baelkin, misdirected Dane's spies, put his own commanders in place to keep the royal family isolated from anyone who would help them, urged Baelkin to orchestrate a strike at the one time no one would expect it, even figured out that the only way not to trigger the crown's death curse was to move when it rested on no one's head. Knowing him as I do, I am sure he planned this coup. Madoc has betrayed Eldred, and Dane is gone, taking all my hopes and plans with him. Coronations are a time when many things are possible. Baelkin looks insufferably satisfied with himself.
Give me the crown.
Eldred drops the circlet from his hand. It rolls a little ways across the floor.
Take it yourself, if it's what you so desire.
Kalia is making a terrible keening sound. Rhaya stares at the crowd in horror. Valmorin stands beside Eldred, his narrow poet's face pale. With the night circling it, the dais is like a terrible stage, where all the players are doomed to run through their roles to the same bloody end. Madoc's hands are gloved in red. I cannot stop staring at them. Baelkin lifts the high crown. The golden oak leaves glitter with the light of candle flame.
You waited too long to depart the throne, father. You have become weak. You let traitors rule little fiefdoms. The power of the low courts goes unchecked, and the wild fae do as they like. Dane would have been the same, a coward who hid behind intrigues. But I am not afraid of bloodshed.
Eldred does not speak. He makes no move toward the crown or toward a weapon. He simply waits. Baelkin orders a knight to bring him Taniot. A female redcap in armor steps onto the dais to grab the struggling consort. Taniot's head lashes back and forth, her long black horns cutting into the redcap knight's shoulder. It doesn't matter. None of it matters. There are too many knights. Two more step forward, and there is no more struggling. Baelkin draws himself up before his father.
Declare me the High King. Put the crown on my head, and you may go from this place, free and unharmed. My sisters will be protected. Your consort will live. Otherwise, I will kill Taniot. I will kill her here in front of everyone, and they will all know that you allowed it.
My gaze goes to Matic, but he is on the steps, speaking in low tones to one of his commanders, a troll who has eaten at our table, has teased Oak and made him laugh. I laughed too then. Now my hands are shaking, my whole body trembling.
Belkin, firstborn, no matter whose blood you spill, you will never rule Alfheim,
Eldred says.
You are unworthy of the crown.
I close my eyes and think of Orianna's words to me. It is no easy thing to be the lover of the High King. It is to always be a pawn. Taniot goes to her death with grace. She is still. Her bearing is regal and doomed, as though she has already passed into the realm of ballads. Her fingers are laced together. She makes no sound as one of the knights, the red-cap knight with the slashed shoulder, beheads her with a single, swift, and brutal strike of her blade. Taniot's horned head rolls a short ways until it hits Dane's corpse. I feel something wet on my face, like rain. There are plenty of folk who delight in murder, and plenty more who delight in spectacle. A kind of giddy madness seems to come upon the crowd, a kind of hunger for even greater slaughter. I fear they may have a surfeit of satisfaction. Two of the knights have seized Eldred.
I will not ask you again,
Belkin says. But Eldred only laughs. He keeps laughing when Belkin runs him through. He doesn't fall like the others. Instead of blood pouring from his wound, red moths stream out into the air. They rush out of him so quickly that in a moment, the High King's body is gone, and there are just red moths swirling up into the air in a vast cloud, a tornado of soft wings. But whatever magic made them does not last. They begin to fall until they are scattered across the dais like blown leaves. The High King Eldred is impossibly dead. The dais is strewn with bodies and blood. Valmorin is on his knees.
Sisters,
Belkin says, striding toward them. Some of the arrogance is gone from his voice, replaced with a horrible softness. He sounds like a man in the midst of a terrible dream from which he refuses to wake.
Which of you will crown me? Crown me and live.
I think of Matic telling my mother not to run. Kalia steps forward, dropping her knife. She is dressed in a stomacher of gold and a skirt of blue, a circlet of berries in her loose hair.
I will do it,
she says.
It is enough. I will make you the High King, although the stain of what you have done will forever taint your rule.
Never is like forever, I think. And then am angry to be reminded of anything Cardin has ever said, especially now. There's a part of me that is glad she has given in, despite the awfulness of Belkin, the inevitable horror of his rule. At least this is over. A bolt comes from the shadows of the rafters, in a completely different trajectory than the last. It strikes her in the chest. Her eyes go wide. Her hands flutter over her heart as though the wound is immodest and she needs to cover it. Then her eyes roll back, and she goes down without a sigh. It is Belkin who cries out with frustration. Matic gives orders to his men, pointing toward the ceiling. A phalanx breaks off from the others and rushes up the stairs. A few guards fly up into the air on pale green wings, blades drawn. He killed her. The ghost killed her.
I push my way blindly toward the dais, past Aslua, howling for more blood. I don't know what I think I'm going to do when I get there. Raya picks up her sister's knife, holds it in one shaking hand. Her blue dress makes her look like a bird, caught before she could take flight. She's Vivi's only real friend in Faerie.
Are you really going to fight me, sister?
Bilkin says.
You have neither sword nor armor. Come, it is too late for that.
It is too late, she says, and brings the knife to her own throat, pressing the point just below her ear. No, I shout, although my voice is drowned out by the crowd, drowned out by Bailkin shouting too. And then, because I can't stand to see any more death, I close my eyes. I keep them closed through being jostled by something heavy and furred. Bailkin starts calling for someone to find Cardin, to bring him Cardin. And my eyes automatically fly open. But there's no Cardin in sight. Only Raya's crumpled body and more horror. Winged archers take aim at the cluster of roots where the ghost was hiding. A moment later, he drops down into the crowd. I hold my breath, afraid he has been hit. But he rolls, stands, and takes off up the stairs, with guards hot on his heels. He has no chance. There are too many of them, and the Breck is too packed, leaving nowhere to run. I want to help him, want to go to him, but I am hemmed in. I can do nothing. I can save no one. Bilkin turns on the court poet, pointing at him.
You will crown me. Speak the words of the ceremony.
I cannot, Velmorin says. I am no kin to you. No kin to the crown.
You will,
Bilkin says.
Yes, my liege.
The court poet answers in a quavering voice. He stumbles through a quick version of the coronation as the hill goes silent. But when the crowd is asked to accept Bailkin as the new High King, no one speaks. The golden oak leaf crown is in Bailkin's hand, but not yet on his head. Bailkin's gaze sweeps over the audience, and though I know it will not settle on me, I still flinch. His voice booms.
Pledge yourselves to me.
We do not. The monarchs do not bend their knees. The gentry are silent. The wild fairies watch and measure. I see Queen Annet of the southmost Unseelie court, the court of moths, signal to her courtiers to leave the hall. She turns away with a sneer.
You are sworn to the High King,
Bailkin booms.
And I am king now.
Bailkin lifts the crown and sets it on his own head. But a moment later, he howls, knocking it off. A burn is on his brow. The red shadow of a circlet.
We do not swear to the king, but to the crown,
someone cries. It is Lord Roybin of the Court of Termites. He has made his way to stand in front of the knights. And although there are more than a dozen directly between him and Bailkin, Roybin does not seem particularly concerned.
You have 3 days to get it onto your head, Kinslayer. 3 days before I will depart here, unsworn, unchecked in power, and unimpressed. And I am certain not to be the only one.
There is a smattering of laughter and whispers as his words spread. A motley group still fills the hall, glittering Seelie and terrifying Unseelie. The wild fae that seldom leave their hills, rivers, or grave mounds. Goblins and hags, pixies and fukas. They have watched nearly all the royal family be slaughtered in a single night. I wonder how much more violence will spring up if there is no new monarch to caution them. I wonder who would welcome it. Sprites glitter in the air that stinks of freshly spilled blood. The revel will go on, I realize. Everything will go on. But I am not sure that I can.
Book 2. Empty your heart of its mortal dream. The winds awaken, the leaves whirl round. Our cheeks are pale, our hair is unbound. Our breasts are heaving, our eyes agleam. Our arms are waving, our lips are apart. And if any gaze on our rushing band, we come between him and the deed of his hand. We come between him and the hope of his heart. William Butler Yeats, The Hosting of the She. Chapter 21. I am a child again, hiding under a table, with the revel spinning around above me. Pressing my hand to my heart, I feel the speeding thud of it. I cannot think. I cannot think. I cannot think. There is blood on my dress, little dots of it sinking into the blue sky. I thought I could not be shocked by death.